Welcome to the Rosie on the House Arizona Hour. Driven by Sanderson Ford.
Your weekend wake-up tradition.
It's Rosie on the House.
And a beautiful Arizona Saturday morning to you all. There's actually raindrops on the skylight when I left the house this morning. I could hear it. Yes, open up. Bring on the rain. It was 48 years ago that the reconstruction of the London Bridge was complete in Lake Havasu City. Took 400 workers 3 years, as opposed to the original when it was constructed in 1821. Took 800 workers 6 years. Robert McCulloch purchased the London Bridge for $2.46 million and spent how much to relocate it?
I can't even imagine.
Seven.
Yeah.
$7 million to relocate it. It was shipped over to the California coast and then trucked in the rest of the way, where it's set on a seven-acre compound during the construction, after which the one-mile dredge, known as the Bridgewater Channel, was then dug underneath it, creating the hot spot of Lake Havasu City today. It's been our focal point this month as our staycation winner enjoyed a trip there. We'll have him on at the end of this hour to talk about his experience at Lake Havasu and his stay at the Nautical Resort, the only beachfront resort in Arizona.
Aren't they celebrating their 128-degree day at Havasu like this week?
It's today.
Oh, it is today.
Yeah, we'll talk about
the hottest day ever recorded.
25 years ago.
128 degrees.
Recorded in Lake Havasu City, and they're having a party to celebrate.
Okay. I knew it was right about now. I didn't know it was today.
They're going to watch the ice melt.
Yeah.
That's a tease.
Man, oh man.
Now, a sad point in Arizona history. Tomorrow will be the sixth anniversary of Yarnell Hill Fire. I finally watched only The Brave this week, the movie dedicated to the hot shots. I couldn't do it. I never had the stomach for it in the past. And it's funny, it wasn't because of the anniversary. It was just a random thing that I started watching it this week and then realized, oh my, you know, we're right up on the sixth anniversary. Have you watched it?
I have. I did. I saw it pretty soon after it came out.
I couldn't believe the cast they had in there. You got to see the dude sing country music. James Hickok was there. I don't know if you remember that. We used to watch a TV show, The Pony Express. You had Old Man Teaspoon that ate the raw onions. The hotshot gunfighter in that was James Borland. And it finally didn't look from that time. He's always been James Hickok. I can never remember his real name, but he's like got the beard and he's gray now. Finally, for once, I think the age and the facial hair, it didn't look like the old gunfighter. But I thought they did a really good job, and most of it was the lead up to it. There was only about 20 minutes at the end where it was actually the fire, and the final 20 minutes, the tragedy that happened. You know, for some of them, you learn that this, you know, they're planning on retiring. This was going to be their last fire season. And everything leading up to it, like the back burn that they had started, and that the airdrop put out their back burn instead of the fire that was started. And then, you know, you don't know if it's true, but the flyover, you know, there was another one that was trying to save them. And in the movie, you know, they go right over the firefighters, but they can't see him, so they don't drop it. But, you know, we're not sure exactly how close that plane was to over him. But just that whole buildup.
I can't believe it's been 6 years.
Oh, and wow. And that they were only 600 yards from the ranch that they were trying to go to. It's actually called the Not Much of a Ranch. They call it something different in the movie and on fire maps, but it's the Not Much of a Ranch. Those people actually stayed in that home while the fire burnt around them and didn't even know the hot shots were over there.
Ugh.
So tomorrow is the sixth anniversary of that, and they're doing at the two things I always remember about that is, one, I could smell the fire from my house. And I generally wouldn't think anything of it, but there was just something strange in that day and the haze that made me turn on the news, which I never do on a weekend when I'm home. And the story was just breaking. And then the second thing that always burned in my mind is Mayor Kirkendall told me about his, where he was when he got the news and, you know, just what it was like in that moment. Those things will forever be burned in my mind. But there is what they call a gourd dance from 11 to 4 today at the Frontier Village in Prescott. And then at 4:42, the bell at Yavapai County Courthouse and Yarnell Memorial Park will ring 19 times for the 19 fallen. So sad time in Arizona history, but
let's cheer it up.
Yeah. Let's little nice way to remember those firefighters.
So let's switch gears.
Through American history, there's a lot of different countrymen that are known for different things. You know, the Chinese and the railroads, the Irish, the Cajun this, the English founders. You know, one of the five C's in Arizona is cotton. And did you know that at one point in time, 90% of the cotton in Arizona was picked by Germans?
I did not know that.
Well, we've got conservator Steve Hosa in to tell us the rest of the story. Can I say that? Can I steal that from Paul Harvey? Or is that copyrighted?
We'll find out.
We'll monitor the phones here. We'll find out.
Good morning, Steve. Welcome.
Good morning.
And you've also wrote a book about this.
Yes, I did.
So set the stage for the story.
During World War II, after the United States got into the fight, the first invasion that the Allies staged was in North Africa. As the tide started to turn against the Germans, more and more prisoners were falling into Allied hands. And the British and the Americans were going to abide strictly by the Geneva Convention in the proper treatment of their prisoners of war. This meant that most of the prisoners were going to Britain and then later to Canada. But as these camps became so overcrowded, Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, decided that they were going to start sending the prisoners to the United States. And the first ones that came here in late 42 were German submariners. These were ones that had been captured in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of the United States. And the first camps were located on the East Coast in Virginia, New York, and Boston, places like that.
And so as we're getting all these German POWs, we got to find places for them, and they gradually go from the east out to the west. And there was a rule on how long they could stay at any one camp. They had to continually keep moving them.
Yes, as more and more prisoners, like for instance after the invasion of Sicily, then Italy, and then later on D-Day, the camps were being built further west until by the time of D-Day, which was June 6, 1944, there were camps in 511 camps total in the continental United States, and that included 24 here in Arizona.
24 just in Arizona?
Yes.
And that list is actually in your book that's called First Person Accounts of German Prisoners of War in Arizona. I mean, this is a pretty extensive book.
I went to Germany to interview a lot of the prisoners of war. When I got out of college, my first job was at the State Capitol Museum and then later at the State Archives, which was on the third floor. And I met a lot of the docents, the volunteer docents, who were citizens here during the war. And as we were talking about the war, they started to mention seeing the prisoners out doing work. And this is something that I had never heard of growing up here in Phoenix. So I got curious and I started to record their stories. And through them, I met former guards, farmers that use the prisoners for farm labor. And then I thought, I wonder what the prisoner story is on this. And so a friend of mine from ASU who was with the Tempe Sister City program, Richard Tischler, he put me in touch with a German veterans newspaper that allowed me to put in several articles. I speak German, so I put several articles in the newspaper to ask anyone that was held in Arizona to contact me. And it was like the floodgates opening. I had over 100 responses in the first year. And I've had many of them come back to visit their former campsites, reunions with guards and farmers. And then we went to Germany in 94 to interview many of them, including some of the ones who escaped from Papago Park in December of 1944.
And I like the way your book layout goes. It's not like you're writing a narrative and recording details from interviews. It's like a back and forth storyline between the actual prisoners and prison guards.
Yes, I decided, because I wasn't alive at the time, obviously, that I was going to let them speak in their own words. It was going to be a first person, literally. And I actually stole the format from a book that I had read in college on the Bataan Death March, and it was put together in exactly the same way. It was simply the words themselves of the men who had gone through this, and I thought if I ever did write anything on this, it would be in that same format. Let them speak their own words, and then let the reader deduce from that.
And this, one of these 24 camps, the one at Papago, was the largest escape on U.S. soil during World War II. It was like the great escape in our own backyard.
Yes, there were other tunnel escapes. There was one in Trinidad, Colorado, and where a trio of prisoners got loose. But this was the biggest. It started on December 23rd, about 11 o'clock at night. And 25 prisoners who had spent 4 months digging a tunnel, the tunnel was 178 feet long, got out, and their plan was to try to get into Mexico and then onto a neutral ship, try to get back to Europe. And I think one of the funniest aspects of the story is I went to the National Archives and I got the official Army account of the escape and the interrogation of the prisoners. And in every case, when the prisoners who had just been recaptured were interrogated, they were all asked, "Why did you escape?" And their answers were all the same. "We hate it here. The food's terrible. Our quarters are awful. The guards and the American officers treat us very poorly."
And we'll come back with the rest of the story. We can do a lot here, but we can't stop the clock more with conservator Steve Hoza talking about the great escape.